This week, we're talking about the things we don't do. We're going to explore the five E's of a successful lodge with fellow Masonic education enthusiast, Illinois Freemason, and Education Committee member Jordan Kelly. How can you ensure your candidate is coming back for more? Here's a clue. It's not by teaching them about how to do floor work or dubbing them with the title of Apprentice Pancake Flipper. Jordan brings his professional expertise to a much-needed conversation about the formula for a successful Masonic lodge. In addition to all this, we also hear likely the most accurate, historically honest, and interesting history of absinthe in an all-new Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day. Absinthe is often considered a mystical beverage consumed by vampires, occultists, and, well, just regular connoisseurs. All this and more, coming right up.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. This is episode number 532. Of course, as you heard in the opener of the show, we've got a great interview here with Brother Jordan Kelly coming up in just a few moments. Before we get started, I want to go ahead and thank all of the producers, fellows, and contributors, and of course, our legacy partners of the program. If you want to learn more about how you can assist bringing this podcast to over 2 million people across the globe who are in search of Masonic light, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show and see how you can assist. In addition, we've also got a shop where you can purchase any number of items that I produce myself just to help fund the show, which includes some of our published works. In the news, things are getting a little bit spicy with the Knights Templar situation with the call to conclave. If you have any interest in that, I invite you to check out call2conclave.com, and you can read all about the things that happened and what's going on right now, including the latest article from the California magazine for Knight Templars, which has a piece that is done by the Grand Master there from the Knight Templars of California about the situation and a warning to the brethren that perhaps all of the things that they are attempting to bring to the floor are trying to be thwarted. So beware. I would definitely give your attention to that because this is kind of a big deal for our Sir Knights out there. Also in the news, if you guys have been living under a rock for the last little bit, kind of crazy, those of you who enjoyed the Found symbol, which was the companion podcast we did to go along with Dan Brown's Lost Symbol TV show. Well, the Peacock Network did not see fit to bring a second season. I know some of you were not pleased with Peacock's adaptation of the Lost Symbol. However, I was disappointed to see that it got canceled. I was really looking forward to maybe a second season and to keep doing the podcast we were doing, The Found Symbol. It was a lot of fun. But such is life. Maybe we'll get to do something in the future. Seeing as it's now February, the days are getting longer. It's getting exciting that the sun is staying out a little bit longer every day, at least until the summer solstice. But I did want to let you guys know that that in terms of presentations and things, the next presentation I have will be on February 19th. This is the rescheduled Illinois Lodge of Research talk that I was going to do, and I'll make sure that that's up on the website so you all can check it out at your leisure, assuming, of course, it doesn't get pushed out once more. After that, nothing until May. So a little bit of a break, but we'll be rocking and rolling right here on the podcast. I want to say thanks to those of you who have kind of dug in and found us on TikTok, doing some behind-the-scenes stuff there just for fun. So if you're interested in that, and it's not always about the podcast, it's usually about other little projects that we're doing here and there, and there's some podcast updates as well. For those of you who are interested in more of the tarot stuff, of course, we're bringing that back to the show just as soon as we get done with some of the interviews that we're going to be doing. There is some information if you're interested in any kind of like tarot readings, basic stuff that I can fit into my schedule can be found at WCYpodcast.com/tarot. And of course, we were inspired by Juan Sepulveda's awesome Secret Society's NFT project. And so you can check out some of the WCY NFTs, which is nothing like Juan's got. These are adaptations of artworks that we've created over the years for the show. But nonetheless, really cool stuff. Some of it's funny, some of it's great, some of it's behind the scenes, some of it's inside joke-ish, but maybe you guys check it out and see if you like it. But anyway, before we get into the interview, let's get into some Masonic Mythbusters.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Absinthe makes you hallucinate. No. No, it does not. Source? Me. I'm the source. I love absinthe. I probably have a glass of it almost every night, and sometimes I have a second glass if I don't have to wake up early the next morning. I'll admit, it gets you very drunk, very easily, and very quickly. But it will not make you hallucinate or go crazy. There are no ingredients or combination of ingredients in absinthe that can make you hallucinate. It is, however, anywhere from about 110 to 150 proof, and that ain't nothing. Truth be told, the most dangerous ingredient in absinthe is alcohol. So why are there all these rumors that it makes you hallucinate and go insane? Partly it's slander to get the beverage banned, but also partly because of bootleg cheap knockoff absinthe that use compounds and chemicals to foe various aspects of absinthe, which turned out to be very dangerous. For instance, rather than doing a maceration of fresh herbs to give the beverage its distinctive green hue, cadmium and copper salts were used to foe the green coloring. Both of those are known to be incredibly toxic to humans. Such knockoff absinthe are part of what contributed it to being banned. A similar fate nearly befell gin. Yep, we don't usually look at gin with any suspicion when we're at the liquor store. But if we see absinthe, we always look at it with suspicion. In the 1700s in London, gin was immensely popular because, well, it's delicious. And knockoff gins were causing madness and illness from chemicals used to foe various aspects of gin. You ought to look up the London Gin Madness. It's quite fascinating and disturbing. Anyway, what saved gin from this devilish reputation? Taxation. Taxation is what saved gin. Yep. You see, in order to ban knockoff gin, you have to define what gin is. And then you put into place taxation system to monetarily enforce compliance with that definition. And then a system of monetary penalties for producing faux gin, in which it would be cheaper to make the real thing than to incur the fines from producing faux gin. Absinthe sadly did not get this luxury. What really damaged absinthe's reputation is a Swiss scientific experiment in which concentrated wormwood essential oils was tested on guinea pigs, which drove them mad and killed them. This concentrated oil had high levels of thujone in them, and yes, in high quantities, thujone is very toxic. In low dosage, thujone can help digestion, liver and gallbladder functions, etc. As the great Paracelsus once stated, toxicity with the dose. Take, for instance, Datura. It is a common plant in the United States and is commonly used as ornamental plants that you'll hear called angel trumpet, or devil's horn, depending on who you ask. One compound in Datura is scopolamine. This compound, if ingested, will, in the right dosage, cause hallucinations. At higher dosages, it will take away personal agency. That is, it removes free will, and is how many people in South America will end up in a bathtub full of ice and a missing kidney. At higher doses, it'll kill you. But in low doses, it's good for nausea and is frequently found in motion sickness medication. Seriously, check your motion sickness meds. One of the ingredients that is listed is scopolamine. So yes, toxicity always depends on the dosage. Now, mind you, wormwood was not banned, nor other beverages that contained wormwood, just absinthe. Vermouth is a popular beverage that is pretty much fermented wine that has been spiced with a variety of herbs, in particular, wormwood. This was not banned, just absinthe. Genipe is another popular liqueur that is pretty much wormwood liqueur. I'm actually having a glass of this right now. I love genipe. It's a wonderful beverage. It was also not banned, just absinthe. If this feels like a double standard, hypocritical, that's because it was. Banning absinthe was purely politics. It had nothing to do with public health. Now, some people will say that modern absinthes don't have wormwood. This isn't true either. Wormwood is an essential ingredient in absinthe, and is in fact where the beverage gets its name, Artemisia absinthium, commonly called Grand Wormwood. Wormwood so happens to be one of three ingredients, plus alcohol, that are essential to defining the beverage as absinthe. Wormwood, green anise, and sweet fennel, also called fennel of Florence. These are known as the Holy Trinity, because there is no legal definition of what absinthe is. So in order to emphasize the importance of these ingredients, they are dubbed the Holy Trinity. Some people will say that modern absinthe doesn't have Thujone in it. This also isn't true. But it is understandable where they get this impression. Thujone is a compound in wormwood, and is not easily removed like caffeine from coffee beans. Thujone is what gives wormwood a slight menthol flavor. Absinthe was not necessarily banned in the United States, just Thujone, at least according to the law, and even that had a degree of leniency. Just as the FDA permits, I don't know, a certain amount of animal feces to be in food and still say it has no feces in it, so too does the FDA specify that wormwood products have to be Thujone-free. But that does not mean it actually is free of Thujone. The FDA does this with several herbs, such as oak moss and yarrow, though strangely enough not with sage or mint. And sage and mint have about 5 to 10 times more Thujone in them than wormwood. So there's another double standard. Now the FDA does not specify what is considered Thujone-free. But the Alcohol and Tobacco Taxation and Trade Bureau does give a parameter. It must be less than 10 parts per million, or 10 milligrams per liter. This is actually well above the threshold for both modern and vintage absinthes, which tend to be in the 3 to 7 milligrams per liter range. Now, a few vintage absinthes were found in which they tested at 50 milligrams per liter, but those were rare. I am not totally familiar with which absinthe brands were being tested, though I have read the study, but I would suspect the producer of those absinthes used a lot of wormwood stems, which have the highest concentration of Thujone in the plant. While not providing a good deal of bitter flavor, wormwood flowers have the second highest concentration of Thujone, and are essential to providing that lovely floral note to the beverage. Wormwood leaves have the lowest concentration of Thujone and provide the essential bitterness of the beverage. One will find old absinthe recipes with the phrase, quote, wormwood dried and stripped, end quote, indicating that the stems ought not to be used. I digress. With so many absinthes testing below the legal threshold of Thujone limits, there was actually no need to change any laws in the United States concerning absinthe production, trade, and consumption. With such evidence, absinthe was able to come back into production without changing a single law in the U.S. Yay! Of course, no matter what you say, no matter what facts are presented, people always seem to look at absinthe with suspicion. Obviously, a century worth of slander and myths against the beverage did some damage, and absinthe has only had the last two decades to recover its reputation. I know people who like to trip on mushrooms. When I offer them absinthe, they'll say, not sure if I want to go crazy tonight. If I have more than one glass of absinthe, you know, people will say things like, whoa, you must be tripping hard. Yeah, of course, they've had like 10 glasses of bourbon, so yeah, I'm the one out of control. It will take some time before these myths about absinthe finally subside, when people look at the absinthe the same way they look at gin. A delicious drink that they for some reason don't like the taste of, and there will be no more remembrance of its degrading past. Now, I do want to add a little side note onto this. I usually only get this question from Freemasons, and it is most likely because of the film From Hell. Starring Johnny Depp, it depicts a lot of the characters in the movie are Freemasons, and there's actually a Masonic initiation scene. Actually, I visited a lodge once where they showed that scene as like part of the education. Now, in From Hell, the detective, who's played by Johnny Depp, he adds laudanum, which is an opium tincture. He puts it into his absinthe, and he drinks it to try and have a vision, trying to catch Jack the Ripper. And for whatever reason, Masons think it's funny to ask me, would you ever put laudanum in your absinthe? No, do not do this. Like, this shouldn't even be a joke. It's a bad idea. First of all, I don't know where you're going to get laudanum. It's been off the market for well over a century, thank God. But second of all, I don't think they properly understood why he was adding laudanum to his absinthe. It's not advisable. Absinthe is already a high alcohol product. Laudanum is an opium tincture. Laudanum was discovered by Paracelsus, or at least he's the first to record it. He found that opium, which is a latex, dissolves into alcohol. It does not, as a latex, dissolve in water, but it does dissolve in alcohol, and thus he found this to be quite praiseable, so he calls it laudanum. And one virtue of it being an opium tincture is that alcohol actually introduces opium into the human system easier than, say, orally, right? Laudanum is more effective and quicker than, say, a painkiller. And it's thanks to the alcohol. So if you mix that with a high proof alcohol, pretty much making it worse for yourself. And if you understand anything about an opium overdose, is usually it's going to be asphyxiation or nausea and causing vomiting, and then you choke on your own vomit. This is why they, you know, your medications tell you don't mix alcohol with painkillers. It's because of this. So if you were to put laudanum into absinthe, you greatly risk overdosing. Not a good idea. And I think many times they're not understanding why the detective in From Hell is doing this. It's because, well, he's a junkie. He is an opium addict. First time we see him, he's passed out in an opium den. And parts in early on in the movie, you see he's out of opium. He can't get any. And so he resorts to a cheap, over-the-counter opium he can get, laudanum. Opium latex already tastes terrible, and then as a tincture, it tastes even worse. It pretty much just tastes disgusting, from everything I understand. And so this is why he's adding it to the absinthe, right? Absinthe has anise and fennel and sugar. This helps the bitter medicine of the wormwood go down. Absinthe was originally presented as a medicine. Wormwood was frequently used as a medicine. So you mix it with sweet-flavored herbs like anise, and it helps the medicine go down. So he's mixing the laudanum into the absinthe to make the laudanum more palatable for himself. That's why he's doing it. I do not recommend it. Don't even ask about it as a joke. And I'm targeting Freemasons by addressing this because they're the only ones who ever ask me this. Don't.
All right. What an awesome segment by Brother Patrick Day and another amazing Masonic Mythbusters. What's so interesting about absinthe is I fell in love with the beverage myself several years ago. I don't know. I was probably 28 or 29 when I first started it. I'm 40 now. So I mean, maybe 11, 12 years of having this on occasion. It's always in my wet bar. And is something about it is just so awesome. The preparation is ritual for me. And I think it is for a lot of folks. I would bet that Brother Patrick Day also enjoys the absinthe ritual, as it were, the melting of the sugar for the luge and all of these things, but certainly relevant to the Masonic conversation because this drink is something that comes to us and people think about the Renaissance and Masonry and the occult and and all of these things. And even if we're just looking at high class society and beverages and all of these things, it kind of ties together. And of course, what he addresses in the end of this is the link between the movie From Hell and Freemasonry and this ridiculous question that people ask about, you know, adding laudanum to absinthe, which, as Patrick says, is just not a great idea at all. It's not even a good idea. It's a terrible idea. So with that, I hope you enjoyed. And next time you see Patrick, buy him a glass of absinthe. Let's get into the interview with Brother Jordan Kelly right now. All right, everybody, we are back once more. We got another great guest this week. I've got Brother Jordan Kelly on. Jordan Kelly is a member of St. Paul's Lodge number 500 here in my home jurisdiction of Illinois. He was the Lodge Education Officer in 2018, and he's the Area Education Officer as of October of 2020. And he has been sitting there for a couple of years now. I want to say thanks so much, Jordan, for coming on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, RJ. Appreciate it.
So, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think you and I have talked with in the past, I mean, we've got listeners and they're probably thinking, you know, Jordan Kelly, who's Jordan Kelly? Well, if you don't know Jordan Kelly, if you're anywhere in Illinois and you're anywhere, you know, in the surrounding states, you very well may likely have seen him at any number of lodge events. Jordan is very passionate about Freemasonry in general. I think we've seen you at just about every Masonic event ever that has any you know, big and small, you're there. So it's really awesome to have you on. And I think what I want the listeners of the program to know about you is that you are indeed one of the worker bees of Freemasonry.
I appreciate it. My wife would agree.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've got a strong contingent of young brothers in Freemasonry. And usually when I say young brothers, I mean brothers who are new to Freemasonry, regardless of actual age. But you are both. You have been a member, you know, not a bazillion years. And you're a younger gent who actually is a business professional as well. And I think it's really great to have somebody like yourself with, you know, the kind of, I don't know, business, administrative, professionalism type take on some of what we do. But that doesn't stop you, right? Because you're also into a lot of the deeper aspects of Freemasonry itself.
Absolutely. And I'm always talking about how I think the two are interconnected, or if they're not, they could be and or should be. They're not mutually exclusive. I've told us, our my own lodge and a number of other guys on numerous times, our ritual lays out a phenomenal way of how to run a lodge from a business perspective, if we studied it, if we knew what it was about. And we don't always, it's like you said, one way or the other. It's all membership, which is great, or it's all ritual, which is great. And it seems as if they're in silos. And we're really working on bringing those two together. And I know we've just talked about that just prior. I know you're similar in that regard. And I think that's hopefully the way of the future. I think that it's showing great success.
I have to agree. I want to go through, for our listeners out there, Jordan put together a little kind of brief thing that we wanted to talk about. And it was just some general notes. And it was called The 5 E's of a Successful Lodge. And when I read it, I thought, this is really nice. It's really good. It's pretty solid. But we need to break it up a little bit. So if you don't mind, I'd like to read portions of it and then just kind of bounce some questions off of you about it and get your general opinions on things as a young Freemason, as a business professional, as somebody who does degree work, as somebody who studies the deeper aspects, as somebody who recognizes the need for the administrative side of the craft and the charitable side of the craft. Like, you're very well-rounded. So if that sounds okay, I'd like to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So you started off by saying stated meetings must have the typical business conducted. However, to recruit and retain good active Masons, stated meetings should be focused on the first 2 E's, which you outline as education and engagement. Now, right off the bat, I'm thinking that's great, but also that's really generic. And for a lot of us, we're like, yeah, no kidding, right? Like, well, So a lot, I would say that people come to Lodge for education or to do engagement, or you can engage through education, but you continue. You say the bulk of conversation should revolve around gaining a deeper understanding of our craft and ourselves and what we can be doing for the community, or for our community rather, not necessarily just charitable works, but how can we be seen to the best of our ability and have an impact on those around us. So let's go back to the first part. Number one, I agree, engagement and education. And I think those are kind of, I don't want to say they're dead horses, right? But we have talked about this a lot in the fraternity.
Certainly.
We know. But when you say understanding of our craft, I'm going to assume, you know, we're talking about the education and the ritual. And then you say, what we can be doing for our community, not necessarily just charitable works. How can we be seen to the best of our ability and have an impact on those around us? So those around us being the community, family, friends, neighbors, all that.
Sure.
But what are we doing? What are some ideas? What can a lodge do that is not like self-serving, just in the sense that, hey, I want you to see us. Hey, we're raising money with a pancake breakfast, or, you know, whatever else the typical stuff is, you know. Well, what are your thoughts on that? Can you break it out a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. Well, and I think it all starts with the mindset that you come to it with. My lodge is very blessed financially. However, that caused us problems of no activity. We didn't have to do pancake breakfast. We didn't have to do XYZ, you name it, because we had money in the bank and we're fine. But we couldn't fill our chairs for a stated. We couldn't fill chairs for a degree ever. And most of the degrees were always done by, you know, an amalgamation of other lodge members from around. Still, to an extent, that always happens. I guess that's just part of the world with masonry today. However, we just weren't doing anything. We weren't doing it. We were sitting on our laurels, so to speak. So we said, okay, well, everybody just wants to write a check. Let's just write a check and do it. And I said, no, why don't we have a golf outing? Why don't we have a bags tournament? Why don't we have these things that guys can interact and be seen out in public, bring their families? I think a lot of times we act as if this is just exclusively for us. But the more interaction that we have with our families and other young guys see families involved, they don't feel that family is a hindrance to lodge. It's that lodge could be an enhancement to their family life. Again, when utilized properly. So there's a couple different things there. It's, you know, when we're talking brotherly love, that is part of engagement. We're not just doing engagement so that we can be seen. Of course, we want good people to know, hey, we do good works. If you want to do good works, come check us out. It's not for, you know, self-aggrandizing or patting ourselves on the back. Certainly some of our stuff, or a good chunk of it, does involve charitable works, because that's something that's always needed. But we get in touch with the schools. I mean, and not just for the Scholar Bowl stuff. We're working with the softball team for one of the local schools here. Working with we have a minor league team here in Springfield as well, working on it with them. It's not charitable stuff. They need some things done. We get a little bit of free advertisement, for lack of a better term. And everybody wins. And again, then we are seen and nobody goes, oh, what's that? Who are those people? What's that? We're going to be seen everywhere, to the point of, again, not even to grow ourselves, but just so people know, hey, this is a group that's here and this is a group that's doing good stuff. I don't know if that answered your question fully.
No, totally. I think that's really a great point, because what we need to do is think about things in terms of, mutually beneficial things. It's okay to think about the lodge's, what the lodge has or stands to gain from doing something. Absolutely. I think much of the time, because we donate so much money and we have so much money in our accounts and things, you know, a lot of lodges do anyway, that we do just rest on our laurels, that we do just write checks. And we think, oh, that just makes it cool and all good. Well, the thing is that when it's hard to say this, but like, nobody's going to know if nobody talks about it.
Right.
Nobody sees it, right? Like, yeah. You could, I had told somebody at my lodge that they found out that I do a podcast on masonry. You know, I had done this podcast for probably 3 years before some people at my mother lodge even knew. And when they found out, they were like, oh, this is really great. But we didn't know about it because you never told us about it. And it was like, oh, well, I just, you know, I'm not about just pushing out and promoting myself everywhere. It feels cheap and weird, but to an extent, like a lodge in a community probably needs to have some amount of promotion or at least to be seen in order to, I mean, there's so many elements to it, but like number one, I'm thinking awesome people going, oh, wow, that's neat. I want to be a part of that. So not only does it get the public opinion of Freemasonry elevated, but in addition, you're elevating the fraternity by bringing in perhaps quality individuals who are also about those things. And maybe along the way, they're interested in some of the deeper aspects of ritual as well.
Yeah. Well, and I want to mention real quick, one of the other things that's a public deal or used to be a much more public deal, our mutual friend Alex Powers has talked about the Masonic funeral, and, you know, marching and parading essentially from the lodge to the funeral home or church or wherever it was and things like those things were public. They were very well observed. And we've had guys join, individual friends of mine that said, oh, I didn't know you were a Mason. Hey, my grandpa had a Masonic funeral and I thought that was the coolest thing. I want to know more solely off of what they saw from the funeral and they felt something special about it. Not to bring up a sore subject, however, but another mutual friend of ours, of course, we all just attended the funeral of Tim Thomason. I wasn't able to actually attend the funeral. I got up there early. However, from my understanding, and I know you were there, it was one of the most impactful and well attended Masonic events, let alone a funeral, but just events in general. And it shows the impact that guy has on someone and how much this thing means to these people. And I think those are other pieces that's engagement, not necessarily for fun. Of course, nobody wants to go to a funeral, but these are things that when you get people involved and active, there starts to be that deeper sense of meaning. Even, yeah, we might go do a golf outing, but then when we go to a funeral, we're talking about some serious and heavy stuff, but that is engagement as well, I feel. Again, it's an unfortunate sense of engagement, but it's something that you can really grow way closer with your guys on, or through, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. In fact, in episode, I think it was our 100th episode of the program, we had Chris Hodapp give a lecture that I actually recorded, and he had okayed it. And, you know, he tells the story about, he had no idea about Freemasonry. He was just like a camera guy, writer, television guy, and he went to his father-in-law's funeral, and he was a Mason, and he was so enamored by the Masonic service, and he joined.
And then he literally wrote the book on it.
Literally. That's right, yeah. and yeah, you bring up Tim Thomason. And so I was trying to write down some thoughts about Tim's funeral, actually. And at the time of recording this, I think the piece will come out on Friday. But some of the observations about the impact of these things, I put in there, and just, it was really wild to me to see, going back to engagement, that there were so many brothers there, like supremely engaged in this thing that we do. And I think also there's an engagement that is born from the services as it is. Like people go to it and they remember Tim and all the stuff he did. And then somehow become reinvigorated by going and remembering what he did. And they're like, you know, we kind of owe it. We owe it to Freemasonry to pick up the work and to do the thing. And I think that has that effect on current members. And of course it has some implication, or it has a effect on the profane as well.
Without a doubt. And I don't want to talk about it too much because I'll actually get upset, but that's not the point. Tim was, if you didn't know, worked at a grocery store, and he was met with the same, if not maybe more respect and excitement all around the state than the CEO or whatever of any business or corporation or anybody else. And again, nothing. That's what I love about this thing that we do is that, I mean, when you talk about meeting on the level, if you put in the effort, I mean, it's just insane the amount of love that can be spread throughout this thing. And the respect that's given. Again, when respect is given, respect is received. And I think Tim's a prime example of that. And unfortunately, his passing showed it to the prime extent or the most, you know, the greatest extent. But my goodness. Yeah, it just shows the level of impact that these things can have on us.
Absolutely agree with you. So one of the next things you talk about is experience. You said, on the degree work and growing membership, our degree work has one sole focus. Now, I thought you were going to say this really goofy administrative answer, right? Like, I've heard grandmasters say the purpose of Freemasonry is to make Masons.
And I just, but I'm, that's like, a, I'm like, I won't argue them with them, I suppose, but
yeah, it's like, yeah, but like, what are you doing? You're not just making Masons, right? Like, you are making Masons if you're actually making Masons, but if right. you're just throwing guys through an obligation, that's different. So then I was like, what are you going to say? You said maximizing candidate experience. We contend on who can best, or you say, we contend on who can best work and best agree, not out of pride or arrogance, but out of a desire to give the absolute best experience to the candidate. So you really emphasize experience for the candidate. So here's my question on this. How can we reconcile this with just getting it done and then the back padding that goes along with this after a particularly maybe a degree that was not well attended? We're always like, oh, he got a great experience. Yeah, it was good. It was good enough. That's maybe a side question, but that's what I'm always thinking about. Like, we're always so quick to go, yeah, it's all about the candidate. Of course it is. In the same token, same breath, or whatever you want to say, like, usually when we take an objective look at what was done, there were like six guys, three of them had to do two parts each. Like, how do we reconcile like maximizing candidate experience if we can't get the guys there to perform the degree work?
Well, it's certainly not easy, I would say. It's, I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh yeah, you can just have a great degree. It takes work. What we found, and we might end up getting into some of this in the next one, but what we found when you give guys these great experiences, and I can go more into detail about some of the specific things that we do that perhaps some other lodges might not do. But one of the things that we do when we're max or what we found is these guys then come in and they're engaged. You know, it goes back to that previous one. So they want to learn the degree work. So now we've got a slate where we have no repeats. Very rarely do we have one guy giving all the lectures. It happens very rarely though. Never will they give all the lectures and the charge. And almost never will the person giving the lectures be on the slate for the, like in the actual degree work itself. Again, that's different. And that took work. That wasn't something that just happened overnight. But when we took ourselves, when we said, okay, this is about them. This is not, I say this after I read the slate for every degree. So this is not the time to practice. This isn't the time to correct. You know, if someone does something wrong, we don't want to hear it. This is not the time for that. And I get a little stern with them. I select a prompter. It's usually our secretary. So he's going to be our prompter. If anybody needs help, he's going to be the one to give it to them. And whether this is your 100th degree or your 10th or first or whatever, this is his first introduction into this thing, whatever it is, first degree, second degree, third. This is his first introduction into that. And we need to remember that. I find often, even when we say things, even like that, we still might find guys joking in the corner. But when we've set that expectation beforehand of like, hey, this is what it is. And our sole focus is going to be this guy. You know, just saying it out loud just sets the tone. It sets the tone. And I feel like that helps it. So again, it's one of these stacking things of you start giving a good experience. Well, then you get enough guys to continue that and fill out a slate and make it fuller. When people see, oh, this lodge is doing something special, they want to come attend your degree. So we've got guys traveling from all over, not the state, but all over central Illinois to come visit our lodge just to watch our degree work or even help with our degree work. Now, of course, like you said, yeah, how do we really know? How do we measure that? We ask, and of course, hey, what did you think? How'd you feel about that? Of course, the candidate's not going to know one way or the other. What we have found is they've seen other degree work and they know what to compare it to. That's one way of measuring it. But one way is that we've found visiting brethren really just say, oh my gosh, that was the best XYZ, you know, whatever it is. To get in some of the details of things that we do beforehand, one of the things that's always stressed me early on was, we say in the, this is only in the long form catechism, I believe it might be short, but I believe it's only in long form, but where were you first prepared to be made a Mason? And the answer for us in Illinois, at least, is in our heart. And I don't find that that's always necessarily true. We're not really, we don't come in prepared. We might have a meal, shake some hands, and we get thrown in a room and say, okay, change your clothes real quick. We'll be back in here. And that's the preparation. They're just straight into the room adjacent to the lodge. There's none of that preparation in your heart. Some might say, well, the fact that they petitioned or that they asked, that shows that they were prepared in their heart. But we really want to get our guys focused. So we pull them aside beforehand, ask them some questions, some introspective things, really have them take a look at their life. And not in a bad way, just like, you know, hey, what could you, if you could achieve your highest dreams, what would that look like for you? We ask them, what do you most desire? You know, things of that nature, kind of giving them some preparation that are going to have some callbacks later on, but also just getting them prepared, getting them in that mindset and really removing, or at least attempting to remove that outside world. So when they're going through the degree, they're not thinking about their wife and kids or their job or whatever. We've already kind of got them prepared. So that's one thing. Again, I think we come in with that heightened experience right off the bat. And then we also prep them afterwards. We ask them about how it went. You know, what did you think? How did you feel? Ask them some additional introspective questions, some things that they can reflect on later at night when they're at home. And again, we just feel like that carries on. It's not just a, oh, you showed up, hey, good to meet you, and then we all go home. We prep them before. We give them some things afterwards to think about. And that really, again, that experience then bumps it up to that second E, that engagement. They want to come around. They want to be involved, X, Y, Z. So I might have rambled a little bit or got off topic, but
I think that's all really important stuff. I think when you're prefacing the experience and we say that the experience is for the candidate, yet part of creating an experience for the candidate is setting a tone with those who were going to be there as well. And I think you touched on that wonderfully. I wanted to ask, again, so your fourth E that you talk about, so you've talked about education, engagement, and experience. This fourth one you called, you know, the general encouragement. Now, when I thought about encouragement, I'm thinking, oh, great. For me, encouragement usually comes in the form of, in a room full of grown men, encouragement sounds more to me like I have to babysit. I feel like I have to beg somebody or like butter them up to do something that they should already know to do. However, this is not exactly where you went with this at all. You say our candidates couldn't get away from us if they wanted to. Steadfast intenders, constant invitations to lodge functions, degree work, and practice. We encourage our candidates to do long form catechisms. So when I'm thinking about this, number one is you say our candidates couldn't get away from us if they wanted to. Why not?
Well, yeah, you know, honestly, that was a little bit of a jab at something that I heard recently at a town hall meet. Well, actually, I didn't hear it because we don't tend to have that problem, as I mentioned, but some other different districts in our jurisdiction had the problem of, hey, we got our guys doing a first degree and we can't get them back for a second, or they got through their second, we can't get them back for their third. And often we find what happens is that they'll just pile them up, kick as many as they can into a blue lightning and hope for the best. Don't get me started on that one. We could have a whole other, I'll just keep quiet there before. Anyway, and that's what we find happens. So anyway, but when I say our candidates couldn't get away from us if they wanted to, our intenders are, well, some of our most active guys. I've thankfully been able to pass that torch on to some really top-notch dudes that are just phenomenal. And young, both Masonically young and young in age, which is great. And when I say they couldn't get away from us, like I said, I mean, if we do your first degree, we've got your practice for your catechism scheduled because your intender is going to be there. And we're going to say, hey, all right, I'm going to come over on Tuesday. Sound good? Yeah, sounds good. Well, we get together on Tuesday, whatever. And their next degree scheduled. They're not going to get away from us. Like, I mean, I can't say that nobody falls through the cracks, but in my time here in 5 years with this lodge, actually coming on six, well, I don't think we've had anybody that's fallen off. And yeah, maybe that I think that that also goes to the experience. When you give a good experience, they want to see what that next thing is. So those two things might be tied a little bit. But again, we're excited for them. It's not, here's your Intender book. Yeah, we'll call you in a couple of weeks, let you know what's going on. It's, man, how was that? We're so excited for you, dude. Was that cool? Hey, we're going to do this education thing. And now that you're a first degree, we're only going to talk about the first degree forms and supports. You want to come? Something like that. So again, that goes back to some of the education things.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you're kind of dancing around here is this idea that perhaps it takes more than masonry speaking for itself. For somebody who doesn't speak the language, that doesn't work for them. And what I mean is it takes an active person to pick up the phone. And you know what? Not even the phone, because the phone is too passive today. The text message is too passive today. Really, it's more of like connect with them and tell them, hey, next Tuesday, no, that's not going to work. Wednesday, you have to put a step outside your front door in order to kind of show people today exactly how serious this thing is and the skin in the game that's required in order to, you know, get the most out of this thing. And maybe it's just a rarity today, but maybe people don't understand genuine happiness for somebody else, that you have an excitement for them. Recently we were at a Allied Masonic Degrees meeting. And for, gosh, it's got to be like 3 years, maybe. This brother was really excited about doing one of these AMD degrees. He just wanted to do it. He wanted to put it on, and he had these aprons made for the degree and everything. And the degree is called the Grand Tylers of Solomon. And we've been hearing about it for 6 years or 5 years or whatever it was. And no one ever just put on the dang degree. Even as a table read. And so finally we just scheduled it and did it. And you know, Scott Duball. So Scott and I were standing there talking afterward, and Scott was like, yeah, you know, almost better than the degree was watching the guy who wanted us to do the degree for so long directing it. He was so excited about it. He's like, that just like made my night.
That's awesome. Like, yeah.
You know, and it's the same when we get a candidate who enjoyed the degree, who went through it, and who, like, afterward, yeah, to engage them in talking about it and pulling, you know, the strings for them and getting them thinking and rearranging what the lodge is going to do to cater to their new best friend. And how do they know? Well, because we're like literally changing everything so that you can come to the meeting, because we love you and you're here and we're really engaged with you. We want you to keep going. And that does make all the difference. But there's probably a lack of enthusiasm as it relates to some of this, right? Like, how many lodges, you talked about lodges resting on their laurels, but like, in that same respect of maybe not being always willing to make us to do actually something for the lodge, something physical, or to have something to do, they just rather not have to reach out. They'd rather not be the intender. Oh, or you get the guy who's like, yeah, I'll be his intender. Cool. And you just like, that guy comes to every meeting, but when the candidate doesn't show up, he doesn't care, doesn't call, doesn't do anything. And then he's like, oh, I don't know. I haven't heard from him in, you know, 2 months. I think a lot of times when lodges have those kinds of problems, we need to look at who their intenders are in the entire process. I think there's best practices that are common sense, but maybe as has been often pointed out in the last 20 years, is that common sense isn't so common.
Well, we hear top line signer. Well, frankly, my father, wonderful guy. He was my top line signer. He's been a Mason for a long, long time. is probably, I mean, he's one of, if not the main reason why I ever joined Lodge. It's why I joined Cesar Good Lodge 744. Funny, I had to give them a shout out because we're talking about St. Paul's a lot, but I actually dual member down in Cesar Good, Southern Illinois. My dad was my attender, but he hadn't studied this stuff in 2 decades. And so I learned long form on my own. And I, you know, give myself a little pat on the back. It's something I am proud of. I thought it was the, when I wasn't told there was a short form, I was just given a thing. It was like, here you go. So I was just like, oh, okay. And again, I think it does take a certain level of engagement. I was impressed with, I had a very good experience in my degrees. I was impressed with what they did. So I was encouraged to do those things, just internally encouraged. Like you said, not everybody has that. And while we want it to be of their own free will and accord, it's something that I, a trap that I've fallen into many a times of being too hands off. It doesn't always work out that way. So anyway, going back to the intender thing, yes, some of the best practices, like at least that's the one that I've always heard, top line signer or the LEO. Well, the LEO might also be the DEO or it might also be the DDGM or Worshipful Master or Secretary. Those things happen and they're probably got a lot on their plate. You know, finding someone that they can connect with, someone that's closer to their same age, maybe has some shared experiences, but also someone that does want to do these things. Maybe they don't know the catechism. They've never done it. Well, good. They can learn it together. But again, you do have to have that drive. But I think that comes with excitement. That's not even one of the E's. Maybe I need to throw that one in there. Kind of comes along with encouragement. But you know, we're excited to do these things. And we want our guys to be excited to come on board and see that stuff happen. Yeah, it's not always the best practices that actually work out. Sometimes they do. But again, I think it should be a case-by-case basis. And a good lot to your point earlier, okay, maybe they don't want to do these things. They don't want to do these things. Everything they don't want to do is just a check mark on them saying they don't want masonry to be around in their area. That might be a little harsh, but laziness, and I'll be, that is frankly what it is. If that's how you're going to act with it, this stuff's not for you. This is for people that want to grow. These are for things that, for people that want to see this stuff succeed and go on in the future. Man, that might be a little harsh, but
I don't think that's harsh. Because it brings up the next and the final E, this idea of expectation that you talk about. Expectations. This is a really, believe it or not, Jordan, this is a divisive idea.
Certainly.
You know, whether it's the candidate having met specific expectations or our current members meeting expectations, I've been told that having an expectation of a certain quality of man to come into Freemasonry is quote unquote unbrotherly. I've been told that, expecting a brother who has, you know, maybe he's the senior warden of his lodge, missing many meetings. For me, I think that's unacceptable. I don't really care what the circumstance is because I think if you have an extenuating family circumstance, then you just step out of line. Mm-hmm. You let somebody else take over. I think that, if you're like, I got into a big argument a few years ago, right? When I said, you know, if you pick the Monday night football over going to the degree, that's wrong. Like for me, like I think that's just the way I think about it. Mm-hmm. And, in particular, if you're an officer of the lodge, it's like one of the highest crimes in my book. So I think having an expectation, right? This is, everybody's like, oh, well, it's a volunteer organization, but you volunteered. So now it's a job.
Yeah. You signed up.
That's right. That's right. And so,
and took certain obligations that hold you to expectations. We can get into that. Sorry, but
no, yeah, I totally agree with you. But when you're talking about here is that you say we hold our candidates and brethren both to high expectations. We expect that a prospective candidate will visit multiple times and have an extensive background check and investigation. We expect our candidates to visit degrees they are able to see. We expect our candidates to do long form catechism as well as complete every question in that intender book before moving on. We expect all of our floor work and ritual to be as near perfection as we can achieve. I like the way you put that, as we can achieve, because that, that allows for somebody to say, well, I can't do that one thing, right? Like you're being understanding in that statement.
frankly, RJ, I don't want any of our ritual to ever be perfect, because I've never seen an absolutely perfect anything in ritual. And I'm afraid if it did, it might open some portal or something. So if we can keep that bad boy closed, I'm good. That's all.
You also mentioned we expect our brethren to be present. We expect our brethren to present themselves properly and observe the solemnities of our ceremonies. We talked about this when you talked about the experience and setting a stage for proper experience, to know their chairs. This is crucial too. We see a lot of guys who'd never really learn it, and they just never do anything in between meetings, and they exist solely in the chair so that because somebody else is, you know, feeding them the lines every meeting. If there's a higher standard available given multiple options, our lodge will choose the more difficult if we believe it is the correct thing to do, like long apron lectures, etc. Totally agree with you. Take the high road when you can. And let's be honest, the fact that it exists means it's possible. So why not try it? You know?
I don't know if you know this. There's a longer version of one of our third degree lectures, and I certainly won't get into detail, but there's a longer version that wasn't given since the early 90s, but it is still considered standard work. And I've seen it given 3 times by not a member of our lodge. He's an honorary member of our lodge, Brother Ryan Flanagan. You know him. He's a Grand Lodge instructor, phenomenal guy. Got the memory of, I can't even explain it. It's insane. And he works very hard at this. He's somebody that holds high expectations when it comes to lectures. We kind of use him as our North Star when it comes to who's going to give lectures. There's a couple guys, but he's a standout one. What are we going to do? If we continue to just shorten everything up, I mentioned long form catechism 4 or 5 times. You just read it as I wrote it in there. There's so much value in that. And when we've shortened these things, and I could use some harsher terms, but you lose so much value. And then we wonder why guys aren't engaged. We wonder why they don't show up again. And go on.
Yeah, well, so you say this, right? And of course, I'm a very, as I've grown older, I grow more empathetic towards, you know, different people and their plight in life and equity and justice and, you know, all of these things I start thinking about. And I think about how we deal with some of these things with people who are just like, oh, I'm terrible with names. And so they use that as their excuse not to learn long form, when really that extenuating circumstance isn't for you. In my opinion, like when you've got like a war vet who's like got TBI or traumatic brain injury, and he's like, this is going to be hard.
We've had some brethren that are dyslexic. Exactly.
So there is a place for the short version and anything else that, you know, the Grand Lodge throws our way. But as you mentioned, the value in long form is not, I don't view the value of the long form return as in, you know, you spent all this time, this is your skin in the game. I view it as a key for learning, because as you read this thing and as you memorize it, you're actually understanding what you've agreed to in a way that is not just the rote memorization of words. Like, there is a greater probability that you are absorbing the lesson, or that you're absorbing exactly what you agreed to do when you study this. It's, it's just more magical.
It entirely is, yeah. Well, and we've had, it comes back tenfold probably to us, because we've had a guy that, because he did long form, he's now traveling around conferring degrees. He was raised 6 months ago, but he knows how to confer because he did it. It's all there. He did everything. It's the working tools are there. The obligations there, all these other things are already in there in the catechism. And because he knew them, he can now go help all these other brethren around the state. And he travels all over the state and the country, actually. So he's doing stuff all over the place and gives great ritual because he knows it, but he doesn't know it from a grand lecture school. Those things have value, of course. I mean, a lot of these things have value. It's not to demean them, but he knows it because he did long form. And that long form catechism is now going to, I mean, we now have people that can confer in our lodge for, I don't even know how long. We've got five guys ready to go. Three of them aren't even officers. Two of them aren't even third degrees yet. And they could probably confer the first tomorrow. And that's just, that's very interesting to me that we've, you know, we see the return both to the lodge and to them as individuals. They're more engaged. We've got a line to get into our officer line. We're not having to fish for people and say, hey, do you mind doing steward this year? We've got guys in waiting saying, can I get an officer spot? And they're qualified for it because they know it, because they have done these other things. They understand the full aspect of the apron because our current, well, he's not our current master, but the guy that confers for us, or the brother that confers for us the majority of the time now, gives a phenomenal long apron lecture for the first degree. And they just know these things that they can go to another lodge, and the brother that might have been there for 10 years might go, I've never heard that. I don't know that. And our first degree guy knows it. And that's not something, I don't mean it to sound self-aggrandizing. These are expectations that we hold ourselves to. And because of that, that's why I tout too much, but I feel like we're very successful in a very short amount of time. And these are the reasons why.
I don't disagree with any of your points. And I think it's fine to be a little bit proud of what you've done. The thing that I always think about is that, when you can, so like an entered apprentice, for instance, when he gets, the apron and you give a long apron speech versus a regular one, he doesn't know. He's never right. But when he goes to that next lodge and he hears the short form and then he's like, oh man, that's weird. What's going on there? He's going to think back like, oh, my lodge did it a little bit different. When visitors come to your lodge, they hear that and they go, wow, that's really something. And what that is also doing, I think, Jordan, is it is aiding in the propagation, or at least the probability that masonry will continue to propagate into the future. You are having good, solid strikes on the anvil. You know what I mean? Like, these are the things, you're putting together solid building blocks. You're putting together examples by which other lodges and future members will look to and say, I want to build on that. I want to do it that way because it was cooler, because it showed more professionalism. It was more theatrical. It was, you know, it touched me deeper. You know, whatever you want to say. But I think it's totally fine to be proud of what y'all have built. I think it's just a great, you know, just a great experience all around the way you've been talking about this. You mentioned in the last paragraph of this piece, you say, as masonry is based on the fifth science, geometry, so is the successful lodge built on the fifth E, right? And this idea of expectation, you say, everything we do begins and ends with holding ourselves to high expectations. So we've kind of talked a little bit about these high expectations, but how can we, like, I want to lean on you a little bit in an administrative, professional kind of way here. Not in the, I don't mean this to be derogatory or anything, but not in like kind of the old boys club. It's okay. Kind of, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like how a father talks to a son after he crashed the car. I don't mean it like that. What I mean is, how do we focus on holding ourselves to high expectations when historically it doesn't feel like, or at least since, I mean, I feel like it's starting to ramp up because more Masons are talking and communicating across the United States and the world. And we're having these podcasts and discussions about these kinds of things. And when people hear that we have high expectations, it validates them in having these feelings of wanting more. But historically, what we're working with today, we really haven't had high expectations. I mean, as much as we talk about all this great masonry that maybe you have experienced, maybe I have experienced, there's 10 brothers who haven't experienced that. You know, outside of thinking about, let's say, candidates, high expectations of a candidate, outside of having him just fit in, he's a good guy and people like him, how do we measure a high expectation? You know, let's start with a candidate. How do you measure a candidate with a high expectation? What are we looking for?
Yeah, well, one of the things, as I mentioned, we expect them to visit a couple of times. I know unfortunately, there are lodges that recruit. We would like to act as if that doesn't exist or that doesn't happen. But I think we'd be silly if we acted like some don't. They do. And I think that they hurt themselves for it. Those guys largely end up in PD a couple of years later. If I could dig into the numbers, I would have a strong assumption. Okay. So we, not only are we not recruiting, we expect you're going to show up to at least two of our events, two, probably three, whether that be degrees, practices, whatever. You're going to have dinner with us. You're probably going to have coffee with one or two of us or a beer with one or two of us, depending on, you know, what floats your boat. And so you're going to meet with some of our principal officers. You're going to, and if you blow us off, you don't show up, you don't put in that effort, we don't feel as if it's your real, really of your own free will and accord, we're not going to go try and reel you in. We want them to be engaged. We want them to have, talk about rough Ashler to perfect Ashler. I think often we forget that rough Ashler has to be in the shape of an Ashler. It can't be a sphere or a pyramid or whatever. It has to have the general shape to work with beforehand. And so that's kind of what we're testing is, are you somewhat square? Can we break off some rough and superfluous edges? Or are we going to have to completely tear this thing down and rebuild it? And it's probably not something that we're going to be able to do. So yeah, are you engaged? Do you have a desire for education or some history? Want to better yourself? Do you want to be involved in the community? That all comes with our investigations. I mean, our investigations don't start with the investigative committee. They start from the moment we get an email, a text message, the moment someone says, hey, I think my buddy would be a good Mason. We might start investigating them via their friend. Like, well, you can invite them to dinner, but hold on, man. Like, let's check some stuff out first. And that's, I don't know, again, I might be getting too vague with that, but that's really what it starts with, is we want them to show, hey, we're about this. We want to be with you. And we find we're not having people fall off, and we're bringing in more people, which is maybe counterintuitive, but it's working. The more you say no, the more you get people that want in. Maybe that's a little right. Supply and demand action. So,
yeah, that's great. That's a great example. Now, let me use the other side of the coin on high expectations with existing members. Maybe it comes down to just motivation. I don't want to give you ideas on how to answer this, but as I'm thinking about, like, how do you motivate somebody to work hard to meet what the lodge needs in terms of an expectation?
I think it starts at the candidate level. And that goes back to some of those catechisms and things like that, because then they're probably going to know whether or not they want to be in an officer position. Are these things that I'm comfortable with? Am I comfortable talking in front of people? Am I comfortable? Catechism, you just got to make one square corner, not too much, but is this something that I want to be doing? So it starts well beforehand, just like our expectations start well before they petition. Our officer or brethren, so to speak, expectations start way before they're brethren. Leading by example, though, so I'm going to kind of shift gears, but so leading by example, that's a huge part of it. We want our officers to, as you mentioned, be at every degree, some extenuating circumstances. Okay. Every degree, every state of meeting, know your chairs, do all of those things. And so when someone wants to get in line, they're not just like, oh, I think I can try that out. It's like, no, you're going to have to be better than that guy. Or if that guy's moving up, you're going to have to be better than the other guy that wants that chair. We're not just going to throw you in there because you're the quote next in line. We do have somewhat of a progressive line, but when we're talking new guys coming into it, certainly not. That's a very specific decision that we make.
And a great answer there for that. Taking it back to candidate level, taking it back to, in particular, in this little piece that you wrote, it says, this process of setting expectations and our ritual. This is the process of setting expectations, and our ritual gives us phenomenal guidelines on how to achieve this. And this is where you're essentially saying that studying the ritual gives us the key to setting some of these expectations on I don't, it sounds funny. Yeah. Setting the expectations of what to expect, but it's true. And then your last line, right, takes us all the way back to the beginning. If only we studied it with a bit more detail.
Yeah. It begins and ends with this, with expectations, but these things are all encompassing because expectations, well, where do we find our expectations? We find our expectations, one in every, it's hilarious that you say, oh, we shouldn't have it. Not that you said that, but that you've heard, oh, we shouldn't have expectations for X, Y, and Z. Our charges are nothing but expectations. They are nothing but that.
You know, you say that, man, and I have pointed that out, and, you know, people just, they have a dissonance about this. And I think particularly, it has an issue with the quote unquote, you know, culture war that's going on in the United States and around the world, to be frank. And, this has not, Freemasonry has not been immune to this.
Sure.
And I think, when we say things like having expectations, and that our first degree, second and third degree charges tell us exactly what those expectations are, I think some guys might, if they really studied what they agreed to, they might have a problem.
Yeah. Well, and not only the charges, I know you can see this, but I also may know our tenets and cardinal virtues, our working tools. Our working tools are maybe not all of them, but a handful of them. If it's not stated explicitly, it's at least implied. It's our working tools are recognizing your own shortcomings and fixing them using these things. So we have shortcomings. Of course we do. But again, that we're not supposed to just be okay with that. We're not supposed to just be okay with our shortcomings. No, we're supposed to be better for ourselves, for our families, our lodges, communities, all those things. We're supposed to be better for those. And again, though, you can't make a non-Ashler into a perfect. We have to have at least some semblance of what that thing's going to look like beforehand. We don't say, you know, we have this XYZ saw so that way we can completely cut down something totally different. No, we're, you know, the tools lay out what we do, and how we are to improve ourselves. Okay. You have to have a deeper understanding of that though. Again, a little bit more detail, a little bit more discernment. So whenever you're looking into what does this ritual actually say, it's not just old English, parse it out, talk about it. And that's where I think a lot of the stuff that we on the education committee, as well as our DEOs and LEOs, I think it's a lot of stuff that they would like to see implemented. Some of them might not know exactly how to do that, but we do a study group every couple of months. We've only had one so far. We were going to have one soon, but snowpocalypse happened. So maybe next week or 2 weeks from now, but we're going to have another study group, and we go through the ritual. So whatever section of lecture we're going to talk about. But then we're going to talk about it. It's not just giving the lecture. It's we're going to break down each thing. And when we can have the slides, it's even better because we can literally say, okay, what's this mean to everybody out here? And we kind of have some conversation about it. And we find that those kinds of conversations around education increase our expectations and our engagement. They increase the guys that want to be around because then they see, well, what are y'all doing on a Saturday morning or whatever day we're doing it? You know, do that, go out to lunch or do it in the evening, go grab a couple drinks afterwards, something like that. So I don't know exactly how I was connecting all these things, but that's the main point is I think these things are all interwoven. And to say that we have to have high expectations, it's all involved in that. I mean, we have to. And I think I would argue probably wrongly, but I would argue that I think every step that we've taken to reduce our expectations and reduce our standards has been one, a step in the wrong direction, and two, probably a direct, our current situation is a direct result from a lot of those decisions in the past.
Totally agree with you. You know, not to make this an echo chamber, but the thing is that when you set an expectation from the get-go lower than anything else, you know, you're likely not going to get much out of that person. Case in point is something that I think a good friend and brother, Spencer Hammond, he had pointed out. He's a DEO up here in the First Northeast, and he talked about this idea of basically undercutting yourself. You know, hey, brother Jordan, can you, listen, we're going to be a little bit short on officers this year. Do you think you could pick up the junior deacon chair or the junior steward chair? And then as you think about it, immediately, like the panic sets in over me and I go, well, Jordan, listen, you don't have to come to every meeting. In fact, like if you never come, it's fine. I just need somebody to be on the rolls.
Like, which is funny because that's my exact situation in York, right? I told them, I said, I'll take the spot, but I'm not showing up because I have a million other things going on. And I said, I don't want to because I know somebody else can do it. And they said, actually, no, it's unfortunate. Yeah. It's unfortunate. But I was like, okay, whatever.
I've done it too with my own York Rite. I've been installed, you know, they were like, oh, can we just make you a Valesman? I'm like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
And so this undercuts the entire thing, right? To have an expectation of these kinds of things. You're undercutting everything. I love the idea of the study club. I love the idea of taking apart the ritual and studying what it means and, you know, looking at it in historical context, you know, looking at what those words meant at that time that this was written down is really important. It's just one of those things where we all of a sudden discover that the story we've been reading is not necessarily the way it really happened, right? Because the historical context changes the meaning of the word from what we think it is today.
Oh, certainly. But
there's just all these little nuances, and by extrapolating this stuff, we really set everybody up for success. And then, yeah, as you pointed out, you know, we've got almost an Ouroboros here of these five E's. It's pretty interesting.
Love the reference. Love it. I wanted to get a tattoo of a snake eating itself around my thigh, and my wife said, absolutely not. So I that didn't happen, and it's apparently not going to happen. But I thought it would be sweet. She said
it would be sweet. I'll have to talk to my wife. Maybe I can get it. Well, Jordan, I want to say thanks so much for coming on the show to talk a little bit about this particular piece. I also want to let everybody out there know that the Lyceum is not just a magazine for the Illinois Lodge of Research, or is not just a magazine for the Grand Lodge of Illinois. It's enjoyed by brothers all over the world. We get notices from Texas and things all the time from somebody out there who picked it up off the website, because it's just a free magazine that we put together as the Education Committee. Jordan has written a few articles from time to time, and you can find some of his work there also. And I would love to put this 5 E's, you know, maybe in the February issue, if you'll be so kind as to allow me to do that.
I'm sure I'll also get a call from my cohort in the East, Brother Lanners, who's going to want to post it with the Midnight Freemasons. If that, I swear he wants me. Yeah, that's okay though. Yes, of course. That'd be wonderful.
Y'all are the pillars of Hercules. You've got the East and the West, Jordan and Darren. Yeah, you guys are amazing. But Jordan, again, thank you for taking some time. I know that we had a Capital Area Freemasons call that was probably going to happen tonight and you missed it to do this. So I want to say thanks. And
I told them well beforehand. I said, hey, look, y'all can get together, but I got to meet with RJ. I got to do this. This is too good to not be sharing with people. And I'm sure they're still going. So I'm probably actually going to just roll right into it. See, now you got me hot. I'm excited. I'm going to go in there and start holding court. And I'm sure they'll all hop off as soon as I do that. So anyway.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Well, thanks so much, brother.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
What a great interview with Brother Jordan Kelly. Again, huge thanks goes out to him for all of his expertise that he brought to us. He skipped out on doing a Zoom webinar with his brothers in the Capital Area, Springfield, to come on the show with us and talk about it. So it's just a great, great honor to have him on. Once more, I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. If you want to know more about how to bring Masonic education to 2 million people, maybe more, all over the globe, visit wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. Feel free to explore our website and check out all of the crazy cool things we've got there for you. Little projects that we have finished or remastered, audio programs like Manly P. Hall. All of these things we've done with the funds that you have given us over the years. just to add to the incredible base of Masonic education resources that we've been able to bring you. So again, thanks to everybody out there who supports the show. And I want to thank all the people also who are sharing these episodes with their brothers and with their lodges. Just an incredible gesture. And it costs nothing besides sharing. And so I just want to say thank you guys so much for helping spread this show and bringing legitimate Masonic education to the forefront. That's it. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.